valued TheStreet.com at both $1.2 billion and at $20 million. That's a lot of room for the savvy to make money and the naive to get shafted. Now that you know the process that companies go through to become public, it's time to figure out how we, you and I, should value them. Determining a company's value tells you what's worth buying. Deciding what's right to buy and what's right to sell, and the best ways to do so, are the fundamentals of investing. People ask me every day what a stock they own is worth. They almost always say, I bought TheStreet.com at $10, and now it is at $4. What should I do with it? I tell them immediately, I don't care where a stock traded. I don't care about the past. I don't care where you bought the stock. The only thing I care about with a stock is what's going to happen next. That's because owning stock is a bet on the future, not the past. You must buy into that notion, or you mustn't buy stocks yourself. I didn't always feel this way. At one point, no doubt like you now, I was completely caught up in the notion of my basis, the technical term both on Wall Street and with the IRS, for the price I paid for a stock. If my basis for Maytag, say, was $34 and the stock was $28, I would let that unrealized loss get in the way of the decision-making process, because I, like you, hate to take a loss. Of course, the situation is already in loss mode, as I like to call it. A loss to anyone but you, because you hold out hope that should play no role in the process. In fact, I would let this basis factor so mar my judgment about the future of Maytag that I wouldn't be able to think clearly about whether I should give up on the position or buy more. I would say, Maytag, I'm down 6 points. Maybe I have to buy more. Maybe I should be bigger because I'm down. Or, obviously, maybe if I buy more, I can make it right, even if I am wrong now. Lots of that kind of logic swarmed in my head when I was starting out. This pigheadedness about my basis, in the face of obvious facts about how bright or poor the future of Maytag would be, made my wife go ballistic. The training goddess knew that the future was all that mattered, and she knew I was being blinded to the future because I was down $6 when I reviewed the piece of merchandise on which I was long or owned. In those grand old days of trading together at 56 Beaver Street in downtown Manhattan, a floor above the steak joint Delmonico's, a downtown fixture, she would insist we get off the desk multiple times a day and go to a bare office located right above the kitchen of the restaurant. There she would go over each position slowly and methodically, reciting each name from our position sheets. After each stock, she would ask me what I thought and how I would rank it on a scale of 1 to 5, a 1 being a stock I wanted to buy more of right now, and a 5 being one I needed to sell pronto. These sessions were extremely painful, because there would be a dripping tone of sarcasm when a stock had obviously gone awry. She was always exacting in her methods. These weren't lovey-dovey clashes between husband and wife, believe me. They were discipline camps. I would try to think clearly about each position she would enunciate, but invariably I would be blinded by my basis. I just couldn't get past the decline from where I bought the darn thing. My judgment was stymied by the stigma of unrealized loss that each negative position carried. Then one day we got off the desk and went to the steak room, as I called it, and she handed out the sheets as always, but the basis, the price I had paid, was whited out. That's right, she had grabbed a bottle of whiteout and painted over every price that I had originally paid for the stocks. There, she said, now you can think clearly. Of course, when we got down to the Maytag position, I was able, at last, to measure Maytag for what mattered, the future, not what I was letting matter, the past, the 6 points I was down on the position. When not faced with the tether of history, I immediately admitted that Whirlpool and GE were kicking Maytag's butt, and that we ought to just face the darn music and dump the stock. From then on, she routinely whited out all the bases of every stock from our position sheets, and our performance increase dramatically. Lesson number one, when it comes to buying or selling a stock, don't tell me where you bought it. Tell me where it's going. That's all that matters when it comes to buying or selling a stock. Besides the past, people are way too hung up on price, the dollar amount you have to pay per share. Most beginners, but also many people who got in during the heyday, the bubble, when everything was working, don't even realize what price is. So let's explain that first, before we explore whether we are paying too much or too little for a stock. When you get a quote, or when you look at a stock's closing price in the morning papers, you are seeing the exact last price at which the merchandise, and this is just merchandise, changed hands. That doesn't mean it's where you can necessarily buy the stock. Stocks trade in bids and offers. You hit the bid or sell it there, or you take the offer or buy it there. The uninitiated use the terms buy and sell, but we never do that on Wall Street. We say take the stock or hit the bid. Here's why. Buy and sell mean buy at the market and sell at the market. Only amateurs and fools enter market orders. Our ridiculous system of buying and selling stocks is predicated upon your being ripped off by whoever gets that market order. And you will be. If you enter a generic market order, the order can be matched with another customer within the system or brokerage you are trading in at a price perhaps at least surprising and at most entirely disadvantageous to you. When I was just starting, I always used market orders, and rarely did the order ever work to my satisfaction. I always felt I was getting ripped off. It was only much later, after I turned pro, that I realized that I was being systematically ripped off by myself, because I foolishly believed that the system of buying and selling stocks at the market was set up to aid the little guy, just the opposite. A market order is a license to abuse you at the behest of a larger client or the brokerage itself trying to find both sides of the trade internally so it can get the full commission on both the selling and the buying instead of having to share it with another firm. So what can you do? Lesson number two in trading stocks. Always use limit orders when you buy or sell any stock, especially when you're buying in unseasoned situations with new stocks or just issued stocks, such as thestreet.com on the day it came public. Decide what price you are willing to pay for a piece of merchandise and then enter it. Never use a market order. You can determine yourself what you think is right, what you think is expensive, or what you think is cheap, and hold out for it. This limit order is especially important in so-called fast markets, when there is news impacting the stock you are trying to buy, making the merchandise a moving target. You determine the parameters. If I want to buy Nortel and the offered, or where I can buy it, is $3.50, but there is news out, a new contract gained from Bell South, say, that will jack up the price, then I enter the order this way. Take 2,000 shares of Nortel at $3.55. That way, I've set a limit on the price I will pay for the stock. In the same manner, if I want to sell Nortel and the bid, or where I can sell it, is $3.48, but Nortel has just lost some important business to Cisco that I know will send the stock plummeting, then I say, sell 2,000 shares of Nortel as low as $3.45. I make up the price. I give the limit. Now, how about that price, that last sale dollar amount? Do you know what that price means? If you go to Macy's and there are two cable knit sweaters, one by Polo made of cashmere and one by Macy's house brand made of polyester and cotton, both selling for $100, you know that something's wrong with the price of at least one of these two items. The Polo cashmere should be $400. The poly cotton Macy's deal should be $49. We can do stuff like that in our heads. We know bargains and we know ripoffs when we see them in the department stores. Alas, if we were only better at buying bigger ticket items like stocks at the malls I shop at every day, the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange. The reason we can't spot bargains and ripoffs when it comes to stocks is that the prices we pay aren't real. They are simply ratios created by the companies through stock splits and share adjustments that often confuse even professionals, but always confuse the little guys. When you buy a cashmere sweater for $400, you know it is worth more than the poly cotton sweater at $49. But in the stock market, and only in the stock market, a $49 stock can be more expensive than a $400 stock. We have to understand how these ratios are calculated so you can spot bargains and overvalued merchandise as easily as you can at Albertsons or Walmart or Macy's. Don't freak out at the mention of the word ratio. I was doing ratios with my fifth grader last night. They are simple division. You know I am going to get you through this with flying colors. So drop your objections and let's get to work. To help us understand the real or underlying worth of merchandise versus the arbitrary price per share that we pay, let's stick with Maytag, the washer and dryer company everyone knows, and compare it to Whirlpool, its biggest competitor. Recently, Maytag traded at $27 a share, and Whirlpool traded at $67 a share. The beginner, of course, says one is $40 more than the other, and is therefore much more expensive. In fact, they are almost exactly the same price, as befits two competitors that duke it out pretty evenly. But you have to understand their price-to-earnings ratios to see through the $27 to $67 disparity. You have to take that last price on that line in the paper next to the stock's name, and you have to divide it. Come on, take it and just put a line under it by the amount per share the company earned in the previous year. Maytag earned $2.18 last year. That's a number that can be found by simply inputting MYG, Maytag symbol, into quote.yahoo.com. This will instantly tell you how much money on a per share basis Maytag made. Now, you divide $27, the last price paid, by $2.18, and you get 12, rounded to the nearest whole number. That's the magic number that you need to know. Maytag trades at 12 times earnings. You are paying 12 times Maytag's previous earnings per share for each share that you buy. That's the real price. The multiple, or M, in this case 12, times $2.18, the earnings per share, or E, equals the price per share, or P. We express the price as an equation. M times E equals P. This formula can also help us figure out future prices. If we know what the earnings estimates are going to be, the E, and we can figure out what we might be willing to pay for those earnings, the M, we can arrive at a future price, or we can figure out how much above or below a stock might be from where it might trade in the future. The multiple allows us to make apples-to-apples comparisons with the stocks of other companies in the cohort. To put it another way, if we have the price and we have the future earnings estimates, we can measure whether we are paying too much M or too little M for the stock right now versus its peers. Any change in the earnings estimates, faster growth, for example, or any change in the economic landscape, such as lower interest rates, as we shall see, can affect what M we will pay. Congratulations! You have just mastered the art of figuring out what a stock is worth and what it might be worth in the future. Professionals never say, Maytag's a bargain because it trades at $27. They say Maytag's a bargain because it trades at 12 times earnings, and yet it is a consistent grower that deserves to sell for a higher multiple. Or professionals might say, Maytag's expensive at 12 times earnings given its spotty history. The subjectivity is in the comparisons to other equities of similar nature. Whirlpool, on the other hand, earned about $6 last year, and it trades for $67. What does it trade at times earnings? What's its magic number? Divide the $67 by the $6, and you get roughly 11. Again, we are rounding, because the precise multiple isn't as important as the approximation. So, Whirlpool trades at a multiple of 11 times earnings. Now we have something that allows us to compare the two companies. We have something that explains the relative worth of each company's shares. Maytag trades at 12 times earnings, while Whirlpool trades at 11 times earnings. That means that Maytag at $27 is actually more expensive than Whirlpool at $67, almost 10% more expensive, despite the prices quoted. We say, using the vernacular of Wall Street, that Maytag is one multiple point more expensive than Whirlpool. We are simply subtracting Whirlpool's 11 multiple from Maytag's 12 multiple to arrive at that 1 point disparity. Do you know why a $27 stock can be more expensive than a $67 stock? There are many reasons. One is that a Maytag appliance might be slightly better than Whirlpool's. A second may be that Maytag's brand has a better reputation than Whirlpool. A third could be that Maytag's management might be better than Whirlpool's. All these reasons do matter. But the real reason why one trades more expensively than the other is that one grows faster than the other. Maytag grows faster than Whirlpool. On Wall Street, we care about growth, growth, and then more growth of the future earnings stream of an enterprise. The other reasons are quite secondary, despite what you have read or heard otherwise. Nothing trumps growth. If you understand that seeking growth, or more important, seeking changes in the growth rate that may be unexpected by others, is the most important factor to focus on as an investor, you will catch all the major spurts in stocks that can be had. That's because stocks move in relation to changes in growth of earnings at the underlying company. If you can predict or forecast changes in growth in the underlying company, either through management changes or product development cycles, or changes in the competitive landscape, or through macroeconomic concerns like lower taxes or lower interest rates, you can predict big moves in a stock before they happen. How is growth measured on Wall Street? To chart future growth, you have to start by looking at the pattern of earnings, particularly earnings per share, or EPS. If you pick up the annual reports or download them online, you will discover that Maytag has been growing its earnings at 9% a year, while Whirlpool has been growing its earnings at 5% a year. Maytag has been growing its business much faster than Whirlpool. Again, Maytag trades at a higher multiple than Whirlpool, 12 to 11, because it grows its business faster. The multiple I have measured reflects past growth, but people on Wall Street presume that past growth can help indicate future growth, and they judge companies accordingly unless the companies make acquisitions, change management, or discover something new and different that can make them grow faster. While not always an accurate predictor, past growth is a terrific starting point for projecting a company's future growth. There's a good analogy for the multiple as a predictor of the future, and once again, it comes from the world of gambling. The multiple is actually nothing more than the line, as expressed in Wall Street speak. Anyone who has made even the friendliest of wagers, say on the Super Bowl, knows that you can't bet on the favorite team without having to spot the other guy's something. Teams are not traded even up. There's a favorite team and a team that's the underdog. You often have to give or take points. That's the line. The multiple is our own expression on Wall Street of the spread between the winners and the losers. Just as in wagering, you have to pay up to place a bet on a superior company on Wall Street. The cheaper company, the underdog, tends to stay cheap, just as the underdog tends to lose. Think of the lower multiple as the handicap, the discount factored into a lesser equity that makes it possibly compelling as something to wager on. But only when it gets so cheap as to make it seem that the line between the good team and the bad team is wrong does it pay to invest in the underdog. Now, let's notch things up a bit and decide how to figure out if the line is right in stocks or whether the market's odds makers, all those buyers and sellers, have created an opportunity because they might be wrong about a company's future. Let's figure out whether the cheaper of Maytag or Whirlpool is too cheap and might be worth buying. We are looking, in other words, for imperfection. Is there something about that pricing that could be wrong, either higher or lower than it should be? Again, Maytag's price-to-earnings ratio is 12. But we have calculated that it grows almost twice as fast as Whirlpool, which has an 11 multiple, or price-to-earnings ratio. I would argue that any company growing twice as fast as another company in the same industry should sell at twice the price-to-earnings ratio of the other, not 9% higher as it is now, because growth is all that matters. So in reality, Maytag at 12 times earnings is more of a bargain than Whirlpool at 11 times earnings, even though they are in the same business, because Maytag is doing better and growing faster. Maytag's the steal at a 12 multiple, and Whirlpool's the more perfectly priced. Therefore, Whirlpool will be less likely to produce a win. The line seems wrong enough to buy Maytag for an investment to bet it will go higher over time, at least as it trades against its competitor. Without having any other insight, I would go with Maytag. The line can be wrong for a million reasons in well-known competitions like Maytag versus Whirlpool. But most investors don't look for the games where the line is most wrong, in younger, under-researched, and little-known companies. Instead, most investors traffic in only the big races, stocks like Microsoft or Intel or IBM. These are the Kentucky Derby and the Belmont Stakes of my business, the most known and written about, where the line is almost always perfect and very little money can be made. The imperfect line happens only when you stray away from the major players. Go to the lesser tracks. In this case, the company's worth $2 billion and less, and especially the $100 million to $400 million companies. These stocks are considered more speculative by the talking heads you see on television or the authors of the dry books about finance. Nothing could be further from reality. The most terrible speculations, as defined by their risk-reward, are the big, well-known companies. You can't possibly get a homework edge on them. Almost all the news on them is already in or discounted. That's why I preach that your homework should focus on the less well-known situations, the markets with smaller, young, growth companies. Although you must accept the risks that come with less knowledge, the rewards are far greater than with the perfect lines of the established players. Of course, there are other details at work in evaluating company stocks besides the rate of growth or the corporation underneath the equity. Before investing in either company, for example, we might examine their balance sheets. When faced with a security laden with debt versus one with a clean balance sheet, I am going to favor the clean balance sheet, because when the economy turns down, too much debt can be a killer to the equity holders. But if a fast-growing company with a great opportunity has to take down debt to finance a worthwhile investment, then the case can be made that the company's indebtedness should not be held against it in the competitive derby for your dollars. That brings us back to the price-to-earnings multiple versus that growth rate again, as a way to figure out whether Maytag is a better buy than Whirlpool. I will still want to buy the more expensive stock, Maytag, because it is only fractionally more expensive, one multiple point, but is growing almost twice as fast. That's simply more compelling than the stock of Whirlpool. On Wall Street, many of the professionals, the analysts on the buy and sell side who compare companies with one another, simply stop when they calculate the price-to-earnings ratio and the growth rate. They make their buy-sell decisions on these ratios. They take the growth rate of Maytag and they match it against the growth rate of the average company in the Standard & Poor's 500, the ultimate benchmark betting line. Then they compare the price-to-earnings multiple of Maytag to the price-to-earnings multiple of the S&P 500. Recently, the average S&P 500 stock traded at 22 times earnings. So Maytag's price-to-earnings multiple is substantially lower than the S&P average. But Maytag also grows more slowly than the average company, because the average company in the S&P 500 grows at about 9% a year. So while Maytag is cheaper than the average company in the S&P 500, as expressed by the PE, or price-to-earnings multiple, it deserves to be cheaper. Most Wall Streeters declare that Maytag is fairly valued versus the S&P index because it doesn't grow fast enough to be attractive. It is therefore not much of a bargain, even if it is a bargain versus its competitor, Whirlpool. If it traded at a smaller multiple and grew much faster than the average company in the index, then it would be a huge bargain. If it traded at a large premium to the multiple of the average stock, but grew much slower, it would be much too expensive to buy. That's the kind of calculation that highly paid, I would say overpaid, people on Wall Street make every day. All of this makes sense in the world defined by Wall Street, but does it make sense in the real business world? Ah, that's still another story. In the real world, Maytag could be worth $40 a share if its much larger competitor, Electrolux, decides it's worth that and adds Maytag to its business collection. In the real world, Maytag could be worth $50 a share if General Electric decides it can't let Electrolux have the property. In the real world, these aren't pieces of paper. They are companies that throw off cash and profits and can be used to augment the earnings of other companies. Businesses have a value to Wall Streeters and a value to Main Streeters. The Wall Streeters care about growth. The Main Streeters care about enterprise value and how much it would cost to buy the whole company. Wall Street loves to be bound by simple calculations like growth rates and prices of a company. All that gibberish about overvalued and undervalued or fully valued comes from comparing the price-to-earnings ratio and the growth rate of the average company to the price-to-earnings ratio and growth rate of the S&P 500 index. Go back to the example of the two sweaters at Macy's. Wall Street is addicted to finding the mispriced anomaly, the cashmere sweater that is priced the same as the poly-cotton alternative. Unfortunately, the big capitalization part of the market, like the mall, doesn't allow for such obvious bargains. So most goods seem fairly valued to most participants because that cashmere item gets spotted by the millions of buyers out there and gets bought, even if it is buried in polycotton offerings. Unfortunately, this kind of calculation, while intelligent and rational, won't make you rich. Too many people, smarter and more knowledgeable than you, can look up these kinds of data and make these comparisons. So while we want to understand how valuations work, we don't want to be trapped by them if we want to get rich. In fact, just the opposite. We must exploit the anomalies that this rigid, arithmetical approach to investing creates every day. We don't want to invest to stay even with others. We want to invest to beat others at the contest of making money. Therefore, while I accept the simple equation that earnings times the multiple equals the price, I refuse to be bounded by it. I want to think outside the walls of the earnings and the multiple, outside the confines of simple earnings analysis, to ascertain which companies are growing fast enough to own. I run a public portfolio called ActionAlertsPlus.com. Unlike every other commentator in the country, I don't mind showing what I am going to do beforehand, so you can run ahead of me. Recently, from my ActionAlertsPlus.com account, I had one of my biggest hits ever, AT&T Wireless, which you could have shared with me and gotten better prices than me if you had subscribed to that site. You get better prices because I send out an email about what I am about to buy to give you a head start before I buy it. In a matter of weeks, I had a double in AT&T Wireless that was accessible to all who read me. I am not bound by the two-dimensional thinking that hamstrings all the high-paid analysts on Wall Street. I am not constrained by the growth mantra, as measured by the price-to-earnings multiple, even though Wall Street is. I see the piece of paper that I am trading, and I remember that there is a business underneath it that the paper can lay claim to as long as the business is solvent. At the time that I issued an alert to buy AT&T Wireless, it was the third biggest wireless company in the country. That was right before it was acquired by Singular, a company put together by Bell South and SBC Communications, two of the biggest landline companies out there. Before it was acquired, the stock of AT&T Wireless had dropped from $32 to $6. I hated the stock in the 30s when all the analysts loved it because they thought the company had tremendous growth ahead of it. I thought the other companies in the wireless phone business would eat its lunch. When the growth at AT&T Wireless faltered, in part because of poor management, something that the analysts who made the faulty estimates don't take into account, the stock took a header. It went to the 20s, to the teens, and then to the single digits. When it got below $10, one analyst after another made the calculations we did earlier for Maytag. In other words, looked at the growth of AT&T Wireless's earnings and the price-to-earnings multiple, and decided that it was too expensive relative to the growth and the PE of its peers and of the S&P 500. All seven of the major analysts were constrained by the growth mantra. They were considering AT&T Wireless as a piece of paper, a stock, not as a company with an ongoing business. Although I care about the apples-to-apples valuations of AT&T Wireless versus the S&P 500 index and versus the other stocks of the players in the industry, just as I care about the PEs of Maytag versus Whirlpool, I am not willing to be bound by such two-dimensional thinking when it comes to the actual enterprises the pieces of paper represent. I grew to love AT&T Wireless, the company, even as its stock was marked down by the market, because unlike the counterintuitive thinkers on Wall Street, I actually believed the company was growing cheaper as it went down in price. No, I'm not being cynical or sarcastic. As a stock price goes down, the business becomes cheaper as an enterprise. And we must never forget that ultimately these are enterprises we are trading. Wall Street loathes stocks as they come down because it thinks of them only as ratios versus the growth of earnings. I, on the other hand, love stocks as they come down because I know the enterprise underneath may not be deteriorating as fast as the stock price. Just as in the mall, I am always trying to spot merchandise that is being marked down below its potential. How I came to buy AT&T Wireless, this fixer-upper of a stock, is somewhat typical of the kind of common sense analysis that I do, that you can do, but that isn't done on Wall Street. My 10 and 13-year-old girls and I absolutely love the Fox show American Idol. We think it is tremendous that these talented youths duke it out in front of a panel of terrific judges. Yet ultimately, we decide who wins with our votes. Unfortunately, every time we call to vote on our faves, we get a busy signal. Every morning, I drive the bus to the middle school, taking my daughter and picking up kids along the way. It's the time when I find out things I should know, but never did during the days when I used to go to work at my hedge fund at 3:45 a.m., so I could trade in Europe. I got tired of hearing how everyone else in the car was voting and getting through, and I wasn't. So I asked one of the girls how come she didn't get discouraged by the busy signals that I kept getting. Why, she explained, she text messaged her vote. I told her that I wanted to text message too. And she told me that you have to have an AT&T Wireless phone to text message. Aha! Now that's a gimmick! That day at work, I pulled the file on AT&T Wireless, and I saw that it had a huge installed base that happened to be growing by leaps and bounds, in part because of this American Idol promotion. Not one talking head analyst alluded to the Fox promotion that was driving so much traffic to the company. Traffic that I figured would certainly stop or diminish once America's most popular TV show finished for the season. I waited until the show ended and then watched as the numbers slid and the signups, overinflated by the television show that probably none of these analysts watched, dropped precipitously. I noted the decline but still did nothing, because I knew that come November 2003, the FCC would force the carriers to adopt wireless portability, meaning we could easily switch carriers without losing our phone numbers in the process. Sure enough, when November and December rolled around, the complaints about AT&T wireless were horrible. The other carriers did much, much better. Then, Wall Street began the sickening process of downgrading the stock from hold to sell, one analyst after another, as the weaker, non-idle inflated numbers collided with the poor service of AT&T wireless sales centers during the portability switch. But I recognized that the brand name and the franchise weren't losing their cachet as fast as the stock was losing its valuation. It was only a matter of time before management would get fed up and realize it couldn't compete with the other players. These managements are made up of humans who make the calculation every day whether they should go it alone or cash out, succumb to others for a higher price than where their shares trade. They want to get rich too, either short or long term. And if their stock isn't going up because the business isn't growing fast enough, they can elect to sell and take the money and run. As each analyst, seven in all, downgraded the stock to a sell and it fell from $9 to $6, I issued alerts saying that you should buy more. When the stock got to $6, I said double down, that this franchise wasn't nearly as damaged as the stock itself. Managements don't like looking stupid. They can and do recognize that their job is to make money for shareholders, although it takes an honest management to realize that it can make money for shareholders only by selling out. It does help, though, that management often has incentives to sell out, as was the case with the bountiful options package that was readily available for all to see in the AT&T wireless proxy, the voting documents for the directors of the company. Remember Andy Beier's rule number 3. Only invest in situations where you have total conviction. What Wall Street didn't realize was that instead of being bound by the two dimensions of price to earnings and price to growth rate, there was a living, breathing entity, an actual business that could be sold to the highest bidder. There has never been a case in history where a company that is not the first or second largest player in a 5 or 6 company competition didn't succumb to a takeover by one of the other players that sought to become the premier largest player in order to take advantage of the tremendous economies of scale. For example, advertising and technology spending that accrues to number one. Sure enough, I had to wait only a few weeks before the initial inquiry came. And then another, and another, and then another again. Next thing you know, while every analyst had a sell on it, there were bidders willing to pay low double digits. All the other players out there. Boom! 15! That's right, I caught a $15 bid from $6 as the takeover war played out. The analysts caught nothing except scrambled egg on their faces. It was all ours, because we refused to be bound by the two dimensions of the canvas. How clueless was Wall Street? Even the best analyst on the stock, the Morgan Stanley fellow who downgraded the stock at $7 on fears of wireless portability, upgraded it at $14 after the bid. How silly is that? If you stay bound by the canvas of the stock, as the Morgan Stanley analyst did, you are always going to miss the bigger picture of the underlying entity. Wall Street cares about the growth of earnings, while business people on Main Street care about the business underneath and how much it can add to their own earnings streams. That's why they will boost their own stock's worth by buying a fixer-upper. There is no magic to pricing imperfections and finding bargains. You just have to know which streets to shop on. And remember to compare the prices on Wall Street with Main Street before you buy. You now know how to buy stocks and how Wall Street and Main Street value merchandise. But what should you be buying and selling? What should you be owning? Should you own stocks at all? How many? For how much money? And for what purpose? For retirement? For fun? For college? How do you build your portfolio? First, I hate one-size-fits-all answers to questions about you. We are all different. We all have different needs and different incomes, different worries and concerns. The fact is, all the calculations don't help you if you don't have an investment strategy in the first place. The most important reason why we invest, the most important reason why we will always invest, is that we don't make enough money in our day jobs to get us through the rest of life. We have to put money away. We have to save. Because otherwise, when we are done working and we don't have income coming in, we won't be able to afford life itself. But we also save because we know that if we can augment our incomes, we can have more fun or give more money away or buy things that we otherwise couldn't afford. We can save to help buy a house or a car or any other large ticket item. And we also save to give to others in our family, for our children, and for the cost of schooling. I mention all these obvious needs because the methods I advocate for each are different. When we are saving for retirement, that's job one, so to speak, and we can't screw it up. The standards are higher, and the risks we take are lower than for any other task because we must have money once we stop working. The other kinds of savings, because they simply augment current paychecks, don't require the conservative strategies that retirement money does. We consider these two streams, the necessity stream, strictly for retirement, and the discretionary stream, as very different animals. Something that is right for the former could be extremely stupid for the latter. Complicating things further is the fact that we do different things and make different choices depending upon how old we are. When you are younger, you can take far greater risks than when you're older because you have more time to make the money back from your paycheck. You also have more time to let the great cycle of stocks work for you. In any 20-year period, high-quality stocks that pay dividends have outperformed all other asset classes. Let's take the retirement stream first. I tell people that the younger you are, the more important it is that you take even bigger speculative risks with your money. Because if you get wiped out, you have nearly your whole working life to make it back. That's why I favor the single most aggressive strategy available, accumulation of high-growth equities, either through mutual funds or through your own selection, until you are in your 30s. Coupled with a percentage of assets devoted to speculation. When you get to the 30s, I like to throttle back the risk level to stocks that pay dividends, or have the prospect of paying dividends within the near future, and cut back the speculation. In your 40s, I like to introduce bonds into the mix. Bonds don't allow much growth of income. They are more a preservative of capital, a place to hold money with a little bit of return, to be sure you have it for later. Depending upon when you need the money, I alter the equation. If you want to retire at 60, I will put more than half of your retirement money in fixed income in your 40s. If you intend to work for years after 60, I would put much less in those placeholders. Your 50s begins the big shift toward more and more fixed income. And finally, in your 60s, unless again you keep working, fixed income should dominate. Your opportunities to grow your money are now limited, and the reward isn't worth the risk. So many people call into my radio show and say that they want to take more risks, that they want more aggressive investments because they didn't save early. Others in their 60s want my blessing to keep the vast majority of their assets in stocks. But I never bend on this. Here's why. I recognize the vulnerability of equities and the fallibility of my own judgment. The desire to let your investments grow over time, to let the dividend and income streams come your way, is what should drive retirement investing. Only as you get closer to needing the money should your caution take hold, so that you don't let a lifetime's worth of savings be wiped out by a swift downturn in the market right before you need the money. What I tell people, though, is that for the second stream, the discretionary stream, the money not cordoned off for retirement, the money meant to augment the paycheck for other needs, the stakes are much lower. Consequently, you can take bigger chances with this portion of your assets. With this stream, you can and must speculate with at least a portion of your money, perhaps as much as 50% when you're younger, in your 20s, and then dropping back by 10% every decade, but never falling below 10%, if only because that's what you can afford to lose without damaging your necessity money. It is with this money that you can take chances. It is with this money that you can and should be trying to make yourself rich with some excellent outsized risks that could give you giant returns. There, you can take as much chance as you would like, and I will most likely bless it, as long as you follow the rules I will be laying out right here. That people don't routinely look at these two streams as entirely different kinds of money, so to speak, with radically different rules, drives me crazy. The mistaken conflation of the two streams leads people to be far more risky in their retirement and way too conservative in their discretionary pool choices. So if you learn one takeaway lesson from this chapter, it is the need to think and act very differently with these two rivers of potential wealth. People who want to speculate in their retirement streams, particularly when they are older, will not get my blessing. People who don't speculate with their discretionary pool of capital are likewise making a huge mistake, provided they follow my rules on speculation. Cramer's Law of Time and Inclination. Should you be running your 401k? Should you be managing your discretionary pool? Or should you hand it off to others? The federal government, in fits and starts, has made saving for retirement a priority. It has created various confusing programs, such as the IRA and the 401k, allowing us to take control of the non-Social Security portion of our savings in a tax-deferred way. The tax-deferred nature of the programs makes them imperative. If you don't have an IRA or a 401k, by all means set one up this very minute to take advantage of the power of allowing your money to compound without your worrying how to pay the tax man. You must have a good menu of offerings to choose from, and you shouldn't have to pay high fees to be in those investments. It's terrific that we've been given control over some of our savings, but it is terrible that the government has given us no instruction about how we should control it, no rules to follow, and no training about how to do it. We teach kids in junior high and high school tons of things that are completely irrelevant, but we don't educate them one whit about how to take care of their own portfolios. Worse, the people whom the government wants us to rely on, the people in the financial services industries, have failed us mightily in instruction. In fact, I would argue that many of them have done their best to try to keep us in the dark, to make us less effective as clients or portfolio managers, so we can be more reliant on them and they can make more money. I preach this every day when I say, let me be your coach. Let me show you how you can be your own portfolio manager. And if I can't do that, I know I can teach you to be a better client. You have to be one or the other, though. Better client or better investor, there is no alternative. What determines whether you are in shape to build a portfolio? When a caller on my radio show asks me for help in managing or building a portfolio, I always tell her that I won't even help until she tells me if she has the time and inclination to manage money herself in a diversified fashion. I need to know both, because not everyone can be a portfolio manager. Some of us are always going to need the help of others who are professionals, either because we don't have the time to do the homework, or we lack the inclination to learn how to measure companies against one another to find the bargains that make for great investments. So let's explore these two great variables, time and inclination, in the context of building a diversified portfolio to see where you fit in. When I speak of time, I am speaking of the time to do homework on your portfolio. I think the rigors of the market demand 1 hour per week per stock to stay on top of it. When I speak of inclination, I mean the desire to do the work. I always say that you need the same amount of time to keep up on your stocks as to keep up on your local sports teams. The problem isn't the time. It is the desire to do the work. If you don't have that natural inclination, you won't spend the hour per team that you need to follow. So you have to ask yourself whether you like this stuff enough to stay on top of it. Now, you might have the time and the inclination to spend a couple of hours a week on your investments, which would be fine if you only had to own one stock or two stocks to get rich. But because of the third point, the need to diversify, you won't be able to spend just 2 hours a week on building your own portfolio. Diversification is the bedrock of portfolio management. It is the only free lunch in this whole gosh darn business. Remember, owning stocks is a fallible process. You must never forget that these are just pieces of paper. Pieces of paper can go down the drain as quickly as toilet paper if they are the wrong ones or we get into the wrong market. That's why we have to diversify. When markets are going up and when whole sectors are roaring, diversification seems like a huge drag. Why bother? When it is sunny, who the heck needs an umbrella or a raincoat? But when it is raining or stormy, or we get a hurricane like we had in the bear market of 2000 to 2003, diversification is your shelter, your virtual brick house that can't be brought down by the elements. Diversification is also a weapon against the malfeasance and the criminality that can engulf the investing process if we are not careful. Remember the people who testified in front of Congress after the Enron debacle, saying that their nest eggs were wiped out because they had kept all of their assets in Enron stock? They had all of their eggs in the Enron basket. In some cases, millions of dollars in this one stock. The day that they testified, I happened to be talking on the radio about how badly I felt for these poor souls who had each lost hundreds of thousands of dollars, and in some cases, millions of dollars in Enron stock for their 401ks and their IRAs. My wife, the trading goddess, happened to be listening. She called in and let me have it, just took me apart. She said, "How dare I feel bad for people who had millions of dollars and then gave it back in the market? How dare I feel bad for people who weren't smart enough to diversify and were so greedy as to not take the care to put their eggs in different baskets? I was just encouraging that kind of behavior for others when I could have been using their intellectual laziness and lack of knowledge about the value of diversification to drive home the point about how easily avoidable such heartbreak is." She was furious that I put the emphasis on the government screw-up in not catching Enron earlier. Diversification, she said, assumes that the government will screw up and not protect us. It presumes that the company's execs will at least let us down, if not loot their enterprise. When she was through with me, I said, holy cow, I better appease the trading goddess and find a way to make diversification come alive on the show pronto. So now we play Am I Diversified every Wednesday. And while it may seem hokey, it works. Diversification is not only our greatest defense against chicanery, it is also our lone defense against the fizzling out of whole companies and whole sectors. We can't afford to put too much money in any one area, because that whole area could wipe out our wealth. When I got in this business, I used to review portfolios that were made up entirely of oil and gas holdings because, well, it was 1982. And wasn't oil going to $100 a barrel? Those portfolios would have been wiped out by the decline in oil to $10 that happened soon afterward had I not diversified these portfolios to less hot areas. Of course, for the last decade, all anyone wanted was technology. But we are now seeing the drawbacks of a portfolio made entirely of four or five of the great tech stalwarts of the 1990s. Owning these stocks now is like watching paint peel. Those who flee from all tech to all pharmaceuticals might have their portfolios wiped out by drug importation from Canada. Each sector at one time or another faces potential extinction. So we spread our stocks among many baskets. How many stocks does it take to be diversified? I have found that you have to have a minimum of five to capture true diversification and protection from the undesirable elements. It would be terrific to be able to have as many as 10 positions to really ensure diversification, but then you'll be bumping up against the time and inclination requirements that I have already detailed. More important, more than 15 stocks, and you have simply become your own mutual fund, something I hear about often in the portfolios people talk to me about on radio or send to me via thestreet.com. If that's the case, if you insist on 15 or more stocks, you might as well hand off your money to one of those mutual fund fellows, although the costs in fees will be prohibitive unless you select a passive model, such as an index fund, which doesn't allow the manager to trade at his own discretion and charges you a higher fee, often for nothing special at all. For retirement, I don't want to include speculative stocks, but for the discretionary stream, one of the five choices should be speculative, and perhaps as many as two or three of the five can be speculative when you are in your 20s or early 30s, and you can make back the money in the event your investment fails. Given that you need at least five stocks in the portfolio to take advantage of the free lunch of diversification, how can you build a diversified portfolio of stocks for, say, less than $2,500? That leaves each position with no more than $500 per stock, making it so you simply can't own enough of any good stock north of $10. That's no good. You run the risk of owning five highly speculative stocks in small dollar amounts, and that's not acceptable. The only way to get enough of each stock with that little money is to be in an index fund, an exchange-traded fund like a SPDR, a stock that represents the S&P 500, or a mutual fund. But if you have more than $2,500, you can easily build a diversified portfolio that can allow you to make excellent money over time. I believe that $500, five positions each for a total of $2,500, of virtually any stock is enough to start out with, provided you add to the positions over time with new money. How do you build that portfolio? You need to find stocks that will go up faster and more consistently than other stocks. I will show you how to do the homework to find them, and then how to do the homework to maintain them. Remember, it's buy and homework, not buy and hold, that matters. Staying on top of your portfolio, pruning it correctly, selecting new positions. These are the fundamentals of the process, and I love teaching them. My methods, I believe, are so much fun and so compelling that maybe you will be willing to give up that one sports event or TV show or movie to focus on getting rich beyond your salary. Believe me, it is worth it like nothing else in the world. When I say we no longer believe in buy and hold, that we have adopted a new regime of buy and homework, what does the homework mean? People ask me this question more than any other when I tell them you need an hour a week per position that you maintain. What am I looking for? What do you need to see? What can be seen? Is the homework even possible? And does it assure success? First, understand that ever since the passage of Regulation FD, a rule set up to benefit you and to hurt the full-time professionals like I was, everything that can be seen, everything that can be known about a company without being an insider, is available to all. And candidly, it is all you need to make the right decisions. You will never have all the information you need, but this public data will suffice. When I first got into this business, I had to spend a tremendous amount of time just trying to find current information about companies. I used to have to go to the Midtown Manhattan Library to read old Microsoft